Welcome to the Protectors Podcast. I'm your host, Jason Piccolo. I'm real excited to welcome Jason Redmond to the show. How you doing, Jason?
Jason, good, man. Thanks for having me on.
No, this is great. You know, you are now my 11th guest, so I'm getting really excited about this podcasting. It seems like it's really taken off. I know you have your own podcast going now, so I think it's like the wave of the future for us guys.
Yeah, I think so too. I mean, it's just, with the way technology is, it's relatively easy to do in the grand scheme of things. And it's a great way to get out good content, you know, for people who are trying to put out positive messages or whatever they're doing. So, yeah, man, I think it is the wave of the future. Everybody's consuming it.
Yeah, it's great. Now, the reason I had you on the show is you're a big inspiration to me. And I know a lot of other veterans out there, a lot of wounded warriors, and you know, this podcast also relates to the law enforcement community who have also gone through those same types of just different things in life that, you know, you have to kind of confront. So that's one of the reasons I have you on today.
Well, thanks, man. I've definitely been very fortunate. I've led a pretty unique life so far, so it's been neat to be living on a second chance and be able to share it with other people.
Yeah, so let's go through your background. I know you were an enlisted guy in the 90s, but where did you grow up before that?
I'm a mutt, man. I grew up all over the place. I am one of these unique individuals that my parents kind of bounced around. They were divorced, and I bounced back and forth between the two of them. So I lived all up and down the East Coast. I was born in Ohio. So for all of you Ohio listeners out there, I will send out a loud and thunderous OH! And I know I can hear the IO coming back at me for the Buckeyes. But I left. I traveled all over North Carolina, South Carolina, Florida. I lived in the Virgin Islands for a while. And then I joined the Navy at 17 when I was still in high school. And then as soon as I graduated, I headed off to boot camp. Went to boot camp in Florida. They sent me to Virginia. And aside from a one-year stint out at SEAL training in California, I actually stayed in Virginia Beach my entire SEAL career, and I grew roots here, and that is where I currently reside.
Now, was that your goal to get into special operations?
Yeah, from a very young age. I had always, my family had a military background. My dad had served, and my grandparents and great uncles. And, you know, so I grew up with all these stories of warriors, and it's what I wanted to do. And my dad told me about the SEAL teams when I was about 14 years old. He was a Army jump master who had done some work with the SEALs back then, and actually even into the 90s, including myself. We used to go through Army Airborne School. So my dad had gone through Airborne School and put some of those guys through training. And it stuck. I wanted to, that's what I wanted to do.
Now, did you grow up on like the Marcinko books and the black face, so the non books with the black faces and all that, are kind of, it's interesting. Your dad was Army and you went Navy.
Yeah. I actually, and it was really an interesting journey because I originally wanted to be a SEAL. And when I went into the recruiting office, the recruiter was a real crusty old school guy. For any of the people out there that have got a military background, specifically a Navy background, this guy was a boatswain's mate, which, you know, is the boatsmen in the Navy. They're the backbone of the Navy, man. They keep the ship running. They know everything about the ship. Basically chipping, painting, and making that ship go. And a lot of times we always joke about the crusty boatswain's mates. And this guy was the epitome of that. And he, he had no time to deal with people who he didn't think were probably good candidates for the Navy or good candidates for his program. So he was the kind of person, he didn't care about being nice or not. So here I was, 14 years old, you know, 5 foot nothing, probably weighed 90 pounds, you know, the proverbial 90 pound weakling, and walk into the recruiting office and say, hey, man, in a couple of years, I want to be a Navy SEAL. And they literally laughed me out of the office. He like chased me out of there. And I kept coming back. He kept chasing me out. So the funny thing is, when I finally was old enough at 16, I went and talked to the Army. And I was originally going to go in the Army. You know, my dad, I had shifted my focus and I said, well, fine, I'll go become an Army Ranger, you know, and then later a Green Beret. So at 17, I started to sign up with the Army. I went to the basic, we call it MEPS, Military Enlisted Processing Center, and they give you your physical, you do all the paperwork. Well, I actually failed the airborne physical when I went through. I had ruptured my eardrum when I was a kid. So when the doctor looked in there, he saw that scar tissue and he failed me, even though I had already dove, having lived in the Virgin Islands and all that stuff. But because they failed me for that physical, I said, okay, well, I'm not going to join the Army. If you're not going to let me go to airborne school, I'm not joining the Army. I'm only joining the Army to go airborne ranger and later to be a Green Beret. So basically, the Army was not real happy with me. They brought me back. I didn't join the Army. And I got the bug again shortly after that, went back up to the Navy recruiting station, and that old crusty recruiter was gone. And they had a new guy who was super cool. And he was like, yeah, man, let me help you become a SEAL. So there you go.
That's awesome, man. You never know. You'd be like the next Tim Kennedy right now if you went to the SF route.
Yeah, exactly. I could have been competing the, you know, what is his, like the hardest man to kill or something like that. I love it.
Exactly. He's awesome. Hey, so did you like, were you training this whole time or did you have time to train? Because that's one thing I always like. I always equate the SEALs to being like, holy crap, you know, this is going to be like, you know, I got to run 10 miles in boots. I got to swim, et cetera. I mean, were you ready to go?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, as soon as I really, now understand there wasn't as much, you know, we didn't have the internet back then. So there was nothing, you know, I couldn't just go online and look the SEAL teams up. You really couldn't find hardly anything about them. The few things I could find was hardest training in the entire U.S. military. Hell Week is the hardest block of training out there, you know, with an 80% attrition rate. And I found some things about what the, you know, the grueling physical fitness you needed. And I wasn't, when I first wanted to do this, I was no, I was no physical specimen, man. But I started getting into sports when I decided to go down this road. I started wrestling. I played football. I was no star football player, but I liked playing and it got me out in the team environment and got me working out. And then as I got closer, you know, 16 and 17, I really started pushing. I was, you know, running every day, lots of pull-ups, push-ups, calisthenics, lifting weights, and really getting ready. So, by the time I got to SEAL training in January 1995, which was 2 years almost after I graduated high school, or a year and a half, I was ready. I was definitely in pretty darn good shape by the time I showed up.
So lessons learned for everybody out there. If you want to go get in shape before, don't think that, hey, you know what, after boot camp, that'll give me enough shape. So yeah, definitely.
Yeah, you know, you got to build that mindset over time. And I mean, if there's any kids that are listening to this, I talked to some young kids the other day. One of the things that a lot of people do when they're training to go to BUDS is they overtrain. They want to push themselves as hard as possible to get ready for training. And they actually end up showing up on the verge of being broken. And then BUDS will break them, because BUDS will push you further than you've ever been. So it's kind of this weird level where you've got to be as fit as possible with your body weight. There's a lot of guys out there that want to run in boots. There's a lot of guys out there that want to run in a weighted vest. They want to run with a backpack with weights in it. I don't recommend that. I recommend you be as strong and fast as possible with your body weight. Endurance weightlifting. That way you try and protect your joints. And because when you get to BUDS, you want to be right at the bottom level of your plateau, because they're going to push you all the way to the top level as you go through training. If you show up and you're already at the top level tipping point onto you know, basically pain or injury, you will sustain those pain and injuries while you're going through buds.
Yeah, that's something I never even thought about. You know, you and I went through, I think, what year did you go in the Navy?
I joined in 92 and I went to boot camp in 93.
Okay, yeah, we're about the same time frame because I was in the Army in 93. And it sounds like you kind of had the same trajectory. So you kind of, you become a SEAL, you're enlisted. Now, did you do a wartime deployment as an enlisted guy?
I did not. No peacetime the whole time. I was actually in school when 9/11 happened. So I was off getting my degree. I was still here in the Hampton Roads. I went to Old Dominion University. So East Coast SEAL teams were around here. And it was hard. It was hard to watch the towers fall and know we were going to war. But I went back to my old command, and it's kind of funny. There's quite a few of us. I did a podcast with Jocko recently, and Jocko was a teammate. We knew each other. We were at different teams back then. But he had been picked up for a commissioning program a couple of years before me. So he was actually in his last year of the program when 9/11 happened. I was in the first year of the program. But apparently both of us went back to our old teams and said, hey, take us out of this program. We know we're going to war. And, both his commanding officer and my commanding officer said, yeah, nope, finish school. This isn't a war that's going to end quickly.
No, not at all. I was actually a Border Patrol agent back then, and I was at my infantry officer basic course when the towers got hit because I was a reservist. And I was like, man, I wish I could just go active duty right now, but it didn't quite work out that way. I had to go back to the border. But yeah, it's crazy. So you,
I bet that was crazy back then. I bet the border security was through the roof. I bet you guys were working your butts off.
Yeah, it was different. It was because, back in the 90s, the only thing we had back then was really Desert Storm was a major conflict. And then, I'm in a border patrol and you're not even thinking about terrorists crossing a border. And then all of a sudden you come back from infantry school after we just got attacked. And it's like, man, who knows what's going to come up and over that fence. And border security was crazy because I was down in San Diego by the San Ysidro Port of Entry. And yeah, we had regular agents going up and out of line, just checking out vehicles, popping trunks, everything. So it was a different time, man.
Yeah. Yeah, it's crazy. A lot of people that were not in the military or military guys and gals who were, I talk about the pre-9/11 military and the post-9/11 military, and it was just night and day. I mean, I remember, the bases I used to be assigned to, they were totally open bases. I mean, you just drive, anybody could just drive on. Obviously there were some more secure parts and secure facilities that wasn't the case, but most bases were that way. And then obviously after 9/11, everything got locked down. And, I don't know if there are any bases out there now that are open.
Yeah, I'm not even sure. The other thing too is like gear. Like I got recalled and I did a tour in 05-06. And the gear they were handing out, you're like, oh my gosh, this is like going to REI. You're not talking like Vietnam jungle boots anymore.
Yeah, man, you're so right. It was the same for us. I mean, the SEAL teams, and we probably had better gear, obviously, than the conventional Army and some of these other units. But we still, you still oftentimes had to go out and buy some of your own gear. If you wanted some sort of Gucci piece of gear, oftentimes the command wasn't buying it for you. And then 9/11 happened, and we used to joke. It was like the Golden Conex box was opened, and you could, anything you needed. If we felt like something would provide benefit on the battlefield, and we could outfit it to an assault troop, it'd be like, hey, we need this. And the next thing you know, man, there'd be 32 of them, or however many were necessary.
That's a great, yeah. Your supply guy went from having a blue Amex card to having like a black card,
yeah,
like overnight,
kidding. Yeah.
So you go and you get commissioned, and do you have to go through like anything special after your commission to become like a SEAL officer, or you're just like, hey, I'm going to go back to the teams?
No. Well, let me rephrase that. So I was in the early stages of the Navy. The Army has a program called Green to Gold. Ours is called Seaman to Admiral. And if we had an individual that went from enlisted to officer within the SEAL teams, when I was coming back, there was a push. We have a training. Once you graduate SEAL training, we have a training called SEAL qualification training. So if you imagine that BUD, SEAL training, is like high school, SEAL qualification training is kind of like college. So there was a push when I was getting ready to get commissioned that they wanted guys who had been out, and, you know, make no mistake, we had been out roughly for 3 years while we were going to school. We weren't out of the military, but we had not been operating, and they had recommended we go back to SQT, SEAL qualification training, that college level. And we all pushed against it. We were like, no, we just want to get back to a platoon. Guys are going to war. And they let us. Funny thing is, hindsight being 2020, we should have gone back through that. And now it's a requirement. If you step away from the community for greater than at least 2 years, you know, if you're going to a commissioning program or something happens in your career, then they send you back through that. Now, you don't have to do all the reindeer games that some of the students do, but you at least get a refresher on all the current tactics and techniques that we're utilizing. So you're up to speed when you go back to an actual operational platoon.
Yeah, I'd imagine you have to get all, like, you know, it's a lot different going from, you know, you could be like a junior member of the team to being like, hey, you know what, you're in charge of what? How big are your teams? 10 guys or?
It depends. You know, a platoon is typically 14 to 16, and then you'll be part of a troop, which is two platoons, and then there's a headquarters element. So it depends on what, you know, level, where you step into. I mean, as a brand new officer, you're probably going to be in charge of a squad, half a platoon. But then there'll be times where you're in charge of that platoon. I mean, you get overseas and now you're taking on combat leadership roles. You know, there were times where I was a mobility force commander on really large operations. I mean, I think at one point, you know, I had 16 vehicles and, you know, God knows how many people. We had almost 70 people in one operation. So, yeah, it all depends on what you're doing in that moment. You know, Jason, the other thing we have is something called junior officer training, I think. And that's something now that our SEAL officers, when they graduate from SEAL training, before they go to that college course, SEAL qualification training, they go through, it's either a couple of weeks or a month of advanced leadership training before they show up at a platoon. So they're learning a lot of leadership things. They're learning history of the SEAL teams. They're learning history of warfare, you know, ethics and all the different things they need before they head off to actually lead.
Yeah, God knows we've had enough wartime experience to know how to train the leaders now. So that's great.
Yeah. Yep. Absolutely.
So now you're an officer. And when was your first combat deployment?
My first combat deployment was in June of 2005. So I stepped in. I got commissioned in May of 2004 and stepped back into a SEAL team and worked up and got ready to deploy. My platoon was actually in Europe, and our sister platoon was in Afghanistan, and we were gearing up to get ready to switch at the very beginning of July. And on June 28, 2005, a lot of people know this mission very well, but a helicopter got shot down as part of Operation Red Wings, Marcus Luttrell's operation. So the guys who were on that helicopter was my sister platoon. So it was my troop commander, and there were a lot of friends. And obviously, we lost everybody aboard that helicopter. So we immediately ramped up, and it accelerated our timeline to fly to Afghanistan. And we got there, and recovery operations were still ongoing. And literally, my first introduction to combat was the ramp ceremony for Matt Axelson and the memorial service for the 11 guys we lost in that helicopter crash. Wow, and the firefight.
that must have been a crazy experience, you know, after all these years being in and then seeing like your friends and everything die. I can't imagine.
Yeah, it was a big wake up call, you know, and it was an interesting deployment. And I mean, anybody that reads my book, The Trident, this journey follows it. And this is where my career got off course a little bit, because I made some mistakes as a young leader. Basically, I thought a little too highly of my skills and capabilities. You know, and this is something where ego really gets in the way of our ability to be good and humbling ourselves to say to people that you've worked with. I mean, so many times ego gets in the way because we don't want to admit, hey, I don't know how to do this, or hey, I'm more senior than you, but can you show me how to do this? Because, you know, we have this warped view of leadership that, oh, I'm a weaker leader if I have to ask you how to do this. Like, I should know how to do everything. And I fell victim to that. And through that experience, because when 9/11 happened, you know, I was telling you, I felt like I should have gone back and done that advanced training. And I didn't. When 9/11 happened, our tactics changed overnight. So I was gone for 3 years from the time 9/11 started, and showed back up May 2004. Well, prior to 9/11, all my enlisted time, we had been operating off a lot of the old SEAL tactics. Really, that went back to Vietnam, which was the last time we had seen long, sustained combat. And when we got into Iraq and Afghanistan, we quickly figured out that these tactics did not work. They didn't work in the heavy urban terrain. They didn't work in the desert. They didn't work in the mountainous terrain. You know, a lot of close quarters combat in these, you know, villages and houses we were having to go in fighting house to house. So all our tactics pretty much got rewritten overnight. And I stepped back in as a young leader who, one, didn't have combat experience, and two, now everything I had learned as a prior enlisted guy didn't necessarily apply. So instead of humbling myself and saying, wow, I've got a steep learning curve, I've really got to lean on these guys, I didn't. And that really kind of spiraled me down a road where I ended up getting myself in trouble, that culminated with a bad call on a mission at the end of that 2005 deployment in September.
So, wow, I didn't know all that. I better pick up your book and start doing a little more studying up on that, man, because I could understand that completely. Because it's, you know, and that's the thing is you have that, you know, you, like I said before, you and I have like from the enlisted to the officer, you kind of think, you know, a little bit more than some people do. And then you kind of have that hard lessons learned, and it is a kick in the butt.
Yeah. And it's, so,
no,
and it's humbling to come back when you were, I mean, when I left the SEAL teams, I was, you know, I was ranked very high. I had done very well as a young enlisted guy. I had run training. I had done multiple deployments. I had seen a touch of combat, doing some things in Colombia, went on to school, excelled in my ROTC program, you know, leaving as the battalion commanding officer for the largest ROTC consortium on the East Coast. So all these things, you know, built a little bit of excessive confidence, arrogance, if you will. So to step into a situation where I'd been excelling so much and suddenly I wasn't excelling was hard. It was hard on my ego. And I'll be honest, I didn't handle it well. And this is something, I mean, I speak all across the country on leadership and how we lead teams and how we lead ourselves. And that is my foundational philosophy on leadership, that there are three rules of leadership. It starts with you and how you lead yourself. And I got that kind of twisted around as I was on this deployment cycle. I was more focused on trying to lead others, and I was hanging on so tight on my ability to lead others, forgetting what a poor job I was doing of leading myself. And by flipping that around, it really ended up getting me in trouble, because the bad call I made on a mission, it's a long story. I won't get into the details. It gets deep into the book in the Trident. And the book is really based around this mission, and it is a evolution of leadership at its heart and soul. And but the bottom line, I made a bad call because I wanted to get into the fight. And instead of kind of waiting to watch and let the battlefield develop, I saw a shortcut. here I was, I'd been kind of struggling, and all of a sudden there was an opportunity, and I said, man, I can go down there and support my guys in this firefight, you know, and hey, I'll look like the hero, which, you know, Jason, being a military guy, sometimes civilians don't understand this. You know, they're like, well, I don't get it. You know, you went in there to help your guys. Well, yeah, I went in there to help my guys with incomplete information that actually prolonged the amount of time they were in a firefight because we couldn't call in air support. And really, at the end of the day, I did it because I was motivated to make myself look better. All things that are not good traits of a leader, especially in a chaotic situation, whether it's in business or whether it's in combat.
You know, this is one of the greatest reasons to have you on the show is because the self-humility you have is just very admirable. Man, you know, hindsight, you can kind of learn the lessons, but when you're going through them, yeah, definitely, man. Definitely.
Yeah. And it's tough. You know, even today I was, you know, I'm always doing a lot of self-assessment just because I write so much content now on leadership and I'm out there teaching it. My second book comes out in December. And one of the things I was thinking about this the other day, one of my biggest flaws is for whatever reason, I have a tendency to think I can be the exception. So if somebody tells me, you know, hey, Jay, 1,000 people have done that and it didn't work out for them. For some reason in my mind, I will think, well, I can do it. And it's both a tremendous asset because it forces me, you know, it's part of my overcome mindset that makes me drive forward. But it also has caused me to endure some really grueling, hard times because I didn't take a step back really to analyze and say, okay, if 1,000 people did this before me and they weren't successful, what makes me think I'm going to be successful? And that's really, you know, a level of humility and something in leadership you have to have the ability to do.
Well, that's one thing that kind of transitioned your story back to the States. So you come off this mission, you made some mistakes, but then you go to Ranger School next, right?
That's right. So, and that was a byproduct. So I made these mistakes. I came home and here's the funny thing about the mistakes. It probably wouldn't have been a big deal. As big a deal as it was. But why it became such a big deal was because I fought back and I basically was like, hey, I did the right thing. You know, I went down there to support our guys and, you know, you guys are just throwing me under the bus because you don't like me. And, you know, this total victim mentality instead of owning what had happened. And because I fought so hard, finally my leadership and even some of the guys I worked with were like, hey, we don't want to work with this guy anymore. Which is a severe blow to your ego. I mean, you know, as a military member and within the special operations community, your tactical and professional reputation is everything. So if you damage that and guys say, I don't want to work with that guy, you know, it is almost impossible to come back from that. You know, if you get that scarlet letter. And I went down this dangerous, slippery road where I kept fighting. And finally, I had guys who were like, kick him out. But I was fortunate enough to have some leadership that believed in me and said, listen, this guy's got a lot of great traits. We just need to humble him. So one of the things they did was sent me to Ranger School. I came home and was home from deployment for just a couple of months before I headed off to Ranger School. And Ranger School was a great school. I mean, there's a lot of, I talk a lot about Ranger School in my book just because it's such a, it really was an eye-opening and a little bit of epiphany moment for me. For the first time in my life, Ranger School forced me to really focus on who I was, the good, the bad, the ugly, my positive traits, my negative traits, what drove me, what motivated me, and really to understand what it is to lead people in hard, chaotic situations. Because at the end of the day, that's what Ranger School is about. Did you go to Ranger School, Jason?
No, I didn't. I'm a leg infantry guy, unfortunately. That's one of the byproducts of having to go back after infantry school to the Border Patrol.
Yeah, it's all good, man. I mean, it is a great school, though. I much respect for anybody out there that's been through Ranger School. It was a lot harder than I expected it to be. You know, here I was once again, you know, ego getting in the way. I'm thinking, oh, man, you know, I've been through SEAL training. Ranger School is going to be a joke. And it wasn't. It was definitely hard. And I learned a lot. But at the end of the day, what I really learned was who I really was and really what it is to lead.
I'm sure it was a great humbling experience. I mean, it's probably something you needed at the time. Because it kind of, you know, that's I'm picking up a lot, like a lot of the traits of humbleness in you. And that's, you know, obviously you're doing a lot of the leadership talking and stuff, but you could tell definitely, like, and especially, you know, the Ranger School, all my buddies went through it, is you kind of get a grasp of what it's like to be at the ground level of almost going back to the private level and then learning your traits from ground up.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, a lot of people don't realize that it doesn't matter what rank you are in Ranger School. You don't wear any rank. Your rank goes away. You know, I mean, people find out because, of course, we talk. But, you know, all you have on your uniform is a name tag. And everybody rotates through the different leadership positions. So one day you might be a rifleman. The next day you might be a radioman. The next day you might be the squad leader, and the next day you may be the patrol commander. And so it's really a great school that forces you to understand all the different positions and how they apply within a military combat unit.
So you get back from Ranger School and you get back, you do, you take charge of some troops and you head back overseas, right?
I do. And that was a long road because I had come back, you know, the guys in the SEAL teams could care less. I graduated from Ranger School. You know, they only cared about one thing, and that was I a sound tactical operator, and was I going to make the best decisions as a leader to take care of them on the battlefield? That was it. And I was unproven. So all they knew is I was that knucklehead who had made a bad call on a mission in Afghanistan. So it took a long time. And you talk about a humbling journey. But to come back and just watch guys look at me with disdain, you know, at times, you know, hey, why is this guy here? You know, I don't want to work with this guy. And I'm really fortunate to have, and this is a shout out to my boss of that troop, who was an ex-enlisted guy also. And he sat me down and said, hey, Red, listen, I heard what happened in Afghanistan. Here's the deal. I don't care. You know, you start from day one with me. So show me you have the ability to lead. Show me that you're part of the team. Show me you make sound decisions. And I'm going to push leadership opportunities on you. And he did. And he looked for a lot of times where really it should have been him making those decisions in training, but he would purposely, I think he knew that I needed to earn back the trust of the guys. And a little bit of it was I needed to reinstill my confidence in myself that I had the ability to do this after this crash. And so he gave me a lot of opportunities to do that. And the great thing about it is it enabled me to earn back the trust with the guys. So by the time we got ready to deploy to Iraq, which was right during the surge and during the Anbar Awakening. So we stepped into combat in Iraq, and man, we hit the ground running doing some pretty hardcore heavy combat operations.
Now, was this 06 or was it a little bit later?
It was the spring of 07.
Okay. Yeah, I was with CJ Soda from in 06 as their anti-terrorism force protection dude. So I ran into a whole bunch of the spec ops community, obviously. So yeah, I was just, interesting time.
Yeah.
Definitely interesting time.
06, 07 was some heavy fighting in Iraq. It's funny, a lot of wounded warriors I know, so many of us were wounded in the 06, 07 timeframe.
Well, I guess we'll transition into what happened in Iraq. Because, I mean, you had a tough time. I mean, that's saying like, you know, that's kind of being a little bit low, really, happened. But yeah,
I had a bad day. How's that? Because I didn't have a tough time in Iraq. Iraq, as a matter of fact, was was the greatest deployment I've ever done in my career. It was everything that I ever set out to do to be a SEAL. We were going after mid-level and high-level Al-Qaeda and insurgent leaders, and we were taking these guys out. And so very effective working with one of the best SEAL troops I ever had the honor to work with in my entire career. Just a real tight group of guys, just amazing individuals. We meshed well, we gelled well, and everybody worked together really well. So really, really successful deployment. And really, I had kind of realigned my career and done a little bit of the impossible. I had redeemed myself in a community of guys that really, you know, if you screw up at the level I did, it's pretty rare that you can come back from it. So I managed to do that. So here we are at the end of the deployment. We're 1 week from going home and we get the word that there is a senior Al-Qaeda leader, a guy we'd been tracking all deployment that was going to be in a specific time and location. And we launched on that mission. And the intel was a little bit off or a little bit dated. As often happens, you know, we went to the first house, he wasn't there, and we really were getting ready to call it a night when our snipers saw quite a bit of activity on another house about 150 yards away. My boss came up to me and said, hey, why don't you take your team? Let's go. We saw some guys run out of this house and run and hide in a field. Let's go wrap them up. Let's see what they know. Because at this point, it's like 4 a.m. in the morning, 3 a.m. in the morning. And, you know, they heard us come in on helicopters. We breached doors. You know, people are not moving in Iraq at that time of the night, especially after, you know, a American military force. And, you know, I'm sure they knew we were special operations came in just by the way we dress and do things. So, you know, make a long story short, my team and I maneuvered and we walked right into a very well executed ambush. The individual we had gone after in the original house had moved to the other house where we saw movement, and they had pre-staged an ambush in that vegetation where we saw the guys run out to. They were the last part of that ambush line. And unfortunately, we walked right into it. And so pretty devastating firefight. You know, we estimate that there were two, well, we know for a fact that there were two PKM machine guns with a crossfire. And then there were multiple, I don't know, 10 to 12 AK-47 shooters. And we were caught in a pretty devastating crossfire. I was stitched across the body and body armor. I took two rounds in the left elbow, which I thought shot my arm off. My medic was hit and almost took his leg off below the knee. One of our other guys ran forward to grab our medic and drag him back. He was stitched up the body, three rounds. Still a beast and still had the ability. This guy, even despite being shot three times, he managed to drag our medic back to the only point of cover we had, which was kind of a large John Deere tractor tire about 15 yards behind me. I was still trying to lay down some fire for those guys when I got shot up by the machine guns again, took the fire off my body armor, off my helmet, had my left night vision tube shot off, took rounds off my gun. I turned to try and move back to that point of cover, the tire, and I caught a round in the face. It hit me from behind, right in front of my ear, traveled through my face, took off most of my nose, kind of exited the right side of my nose. So it blew out my right cheekbone. It traveled right under my eye. So it kind of vaporized my orbital floor, blew that out. My eye dropped down into this newfound hole in my face. It broke all the bones above my eye and it shattered my jaw. And, you know, my guys saw me get hit and fall and thought, you know, that's it. You know, he's dead. But thankfully, I came to again. I mean, to this day, nobody really knows that timeline. The firefight lasted 35 to 40 minutes. I was hit in the first few minutes. So I don't know how long I was out. But at some point, 5-10 minutes, I came to and literally was laying under tracer fire from the machine gun. I was just totally pinned down. And I had to be patient. I had to wait for my guys to win that firefight. And thankfully they did. My team leader ran forward at a point in the fire and got me pulled back. He got a tourniquet on my mangled arm that had taken two rounds. You know, and they did what they could. They stuffed a lot of, you know, stuff into my face to try and, you know, slow down the bleeding there and, you know, effectively save my life before, you know, we ended up calling in the closest fire mission in the entire Iraq war. We called fire directly in on our position from an AC-130 gunship. And we owe our lives to those guys because there was no place we could have gone. You know, literally thousands of yards of empty Iraqi desert behind us and three of us bleeding out. So Medevac came in and was able to get us and took us to Baghdad, and we were all within the golden hour. So, you know, we were able to survive.
Yeah, I don't even know what to say right now. I mean, I read these stories, and then to hear it from you, coming from you, it's just like, I just can't even imagine it. I mean, just, wow, man.
Wow. It's surreal. And I have a lot of people, I had some nightmares in the beginning. I have a lot of people that are like, oh man, do you still have nightmares about it? And I maybe in a blue moon, but really I think part of it, by talking about it all the time, it gives me power over it. And, you know, it just happened. It's part of war, unfortunately. And it's part of the job that I accepted. I feel fortunate that I got a second chance and I got to come home. I got so many friends that didn't get that second chance, guys who were better operators than I was. So, you know, now it really, I talk about it, became this catalyst for me. It became this second chance that I said, okay, I can't waste this time. I've got to make the most of it.
Well, that's one thing you said in the beginning. You said you had a bad day, and I'm sure that has resonated with a lot of the wounded warriors you've came in contact with. Because what happened, you get medevaced and you come back to the States and you become an inspiration, and that's kind of what it took off from there. That's, you know, that's what I'm getting from you. And that's, I mean, I've been following you for a while.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it is a mindset. And I tell people this, I mean, having terrible things happen to you, and this is really, my whole second book is built around this idea. It's called Overcome. And it is built around this idea. So for my entire adult life, I trained to go after the enemy. And one of the things I learned in, you know, different direct action missions was how to execute an ambush, how to select a location that I could pin the enemy down and deliver as much overwhelming firepower on them as possible to either kill them or contain them in an area. And that's what we're trying to do with an ambush. Well, now fast forward to September 13, 2007, I find myself on the receiving end of that, and it sucked. It is so overwhelming to be on the receiving end of thousands of bullets. I mean, literally your mind says, all I want to do is crawl into this hole. I literally dig a hole in the ground and just pray that this will stop. But obviously you can't, because you're going to die. Number two, I was a leader. So I had to think about, you know, okay, where do we go? How do we move? What do? We got to fight back. What assets do I have? Who's hit? All these different things. So fast forward from that moment to getting into the hospital, and I kind of stepped into my next level of ambush. And that was the overwhelming firepower that was coming in from the doctors and nurses who said, hey, LT, it's going to take years to put you back together. You are broken. You know, your face is destroyed and shattered. You know, it's going to take a really long time. And that was a real shock. And I started to realize there was a correlation, because I watched so many other wounded warriors do this, and I watched it through other people that have been through traumatic events that I now call them life ambushes. When you have a catastrophic event that occurs in your life, whether it's an injury, whether it is a divorce, whether it is a financial crisis, you know, some of the higher levels are obvious, injury or illness to a loved one. It could be sexual trauma. It could be the unexpected loss of a child. These are all life ambushes. But the interesting thing about them is people tend to do the exact same thing in a life ambush as they do in an actual enemy ambush. They want to hunker down. They don't want to move. They're overwhelmed, and they freeze. And oftentimes they will sit there forever in this state, not willing to move. And as a matter of fact, what so many people have a tendency to do is look back at the past. They want to be back out of this moment, and they want to have back what they lost. But the problem is, you can't. One, if you're in the middle of the life ambush at that time, obviously, that's not the time to wish for that. And two, The further you get away from it, you can't go back and change what happened. You can't change the past. And those were some of the things that I figured out in the beginning. I was like, you're never going to be able to change what happened. All you can do is drive forward. So coming full circle, what we taught in special operations, the only way to survive an ambush is to get off the X. And that is what my team did. We got off the X. My team leader managed to get me off the X. We brought in fire on the position to enable us to get off the X. And in life, it's the same thing. So there are people out there right now that are going through a life ambush. They've had some sort of catastrophic event. They've had failure, crisis, adversity. They're going through extreme change and they're stuck. And the funny thing is, the longer you sit on the X, it's like quicksand. It pulls you down. So you have to basically recognize you're in an ambush. Then you have to evaluate where you're going to go. You have to assess, what are my options? What are the best options? You've got to choose and communicate what option you're going to take. And then you have to execute. And this is something I go deep into in my book, how we get through those things. But working with wounded warriors, working with individuals that have been through major catastrophic life ambushes, this is how I'm trying to help them. And I know I'm able to help businesses and I'm able to help other individuals through coaching and things I'm doing. It's been pretty exciting to take all this and make it relevant and relatable.
Now, when does your book come out? This October?
No, it comes out December 10th.
December.
So yeah, they've got the publishing industry likes to take their time. They want to make sure they get everything in place. But I'm pretty excited. So if any of you are out there and you're listening to me, you know, follow me on, I'm really active on Instagram, Jason Redman WW. And you'll see all the stuff I'm putting out about the book. We'll be doing pre-sales, pre-orders and all that.
Now, you know, and to go back to what you were saying, it's like, you know, not, we'll talk about the book in a second, but everything seems to be like the military decision-making process. And that's everything we've learned over the past, 18, 19 years of war now is like, you can see it coming into the leadership, the corporate governance and everything. And it's the military decision-making process and how you can relate it to so much in your life.
Yep. And it's so true. I mean, the military does such a good job. I mean, the civilian world is less structured than the military, and that creates a level of frustration for some military guys. But if you can figure out how to make it relatable, where the average person can listen to it and say, man, that makes sense, you know, and you're not expecting them to be Achilles when they do it, it works.
And the life ambushes, man, that's... I'm using that one for now on. I'm going to be like, you know, whenever I'm feeling down in the dumps, I'm like, I got to get out of these ambushes, man.
Yeah. You got to get off the X. And
exactly.
We all are guilty. Even me, I have days where, you know, we all have that little negativity demon. I call mine my demon that lives inside of us. And here I am. I'm Jason Overcome Redman. I'm the guy who wrote The Sign on the Door, New York Times bestselling author, speak all across the country. And I'll have days where I'm like, man, you know, who are you to get out there and speak and tell these things? And it's just, it's a little mental ambush is all it is. And I have to tell myself, I say, Jay, you got to get off the X. Let's get some positive energy. Let's go make a difference. Let's move the needle somewhere. And that's really what it is about. Movement is life. And I teach something called the Pentagon of Peak Performance. There's five key areas that you have to lead yourself in order to be an effective leader and in order to be balanced. And the interesting thing about these five key areas, it took me a long time to come to this and to develop this, but it came about because after my injury, so many people would say to me, Jay, yeah, how are you excelling? So, you know, you just launched from that battlefield ambush. You know, you've like never looked back. I mean, we have so many other wounded warriors who are struggling with PTSD and they can't move past it. How did you do it? And I never really knew the answer. I would just say, oh, you know, it's my overcome mindset, you know? And it was only years later, and as I really started to prepare and write this second book, that I came up with these five key areas that I was really strong in and I was really balanced in when I got wounded. And those five things are physical leadership is the foundational level. So when I was wounded, I was in the absolute best shape of my life because I had redeemed myself and I was trying to screen for our next level SEAL team. So literally the doctors told me your fitness saved your life. The level of fitness, like the average person could not have sustained the amount of blood they lost and survived, but your fitness saved you. So that translates to everybody out there. I mean, your physical fitness impacts your energy levels. It impacts, you know, how you handle stress. So that's the foundational level. Second level is mental leadership, our ability to endure stress, our ability to take on knowledge. How often are we reading and consuming? How often do we find mentors to share with us experiences, because you can't go through every experience in life on your own. How often do you push yourself outside of your comfort zone to expand your overcome mindset and your resiliency? Number three is emotional leadership. How we manage our emotions in chaotic times. I mean, it's easy to be happy when everything's going right, but life doesn't work that way. And when you're in major crisis, if you're in a life ambush, you know, we have a natural tendency to, you know, just kind of fall apart and become, you know, negative Nancy. When you're a leader, you cannot do that. You know, you learn that in the military, Jason, but we're all guilty of it. So emotional leadership is our ability to understand, hey, attitude's going to determine the outcome. Social leadership is the fourth level. It's how we build the teams of people around us. So if you build strong teams, when those crises occur, they're going to be there for you. If you did not invest in those teams as you've gone along in life, if you were weak in that area, maybe you were so focused on work that you didn't put the time into taking care of your family and your close friends. Well, you have a major life ambush, and now all of a sudden you're looking for them, and maybe they're not around because you didn't put the time into them. Mine was rock solid when I was wounded. And the last one is spiritual leadership. For me, that is religion. I'm a Christian. Not everybody out there believes that. I'm sure there are some listening right now that are like, yeah, you're a kook. Whatever. That's my belief. And I respect other people who believe other things. When I talk about spiritual leadership, I talk about getting outside of yourself, understanding there is a bigger world, understanding that our ability to give back and our ability to have perspective for everything that's going on this planet is really spiritual leadership, you know, and there are a lot of ways to get there through meditation, through yoga, maybe breathing exercises. For some, it's religion. For others, it's, you know, gratitude. For some, it's philanthropic endeavors, charitable work, things like that. I was rock solid strong in all five of those areas, and that enabled me to not only survive my ambush, but thrive and launch from it. And that's what I'm trying to teach people now, that you've got to build yourself in these five areas if you want to be ready for these moments when they come.
And the thing is, it's not when they come, it's they are going to come. You know they're going to come.
Spot on. The average human will go through about five life ambushes. So major catastrophic events that will leave a physical, mental, or emotional scar on you over your lifetime.
Now, you know, I'm absolutely ready for that book right now. Come on. When's December? 8 months from now?
Yeah.
Well, Jason, you know, I could actually talk to you probably for another 3 hours, but I know you're a busy guy. And there's a lot more. We got to have you come back. I'm going to have you come back on soon, especially before the book comes out, man, if you like. There's a lot of your story out there that's great. And, you know, it's really cool hearing it from, you know, hearing it right from you. And I'm glad this podcast is set up. It's more for like the military, LEO, first responders. So it's like a different, I'm trying to get it out there to like a different audience so we can all kind of learn off of each other. And I really appreciate your lessons. I've learned a ton today. It's like lessons learned through your experience. And, I really appreciate you coming on. So we could find you on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter.
Yeah, absolutely. So you can go to my website, jasonredmond.com. And from there, you know, if you run a company or if you work with a company and you're interested in having me come in to deliver a keynote, I can do that. I also, this year, I've started getting into workshops. I just did a fantastic workshop with the Grant County Sheriff's Department out in Washington on leadership change, that whole Pentagon of Peak Performance, how we prepare for ambushes and crisis, and how to implement long-term change. So you can book me through that. If you're interested in a signed copy of The Trident, my first New York Times bestselling book, you can get a copy of that. And then, of course, I'm on all the social media platforms. Jason, I've also launched something recently that a lot of people have been interested in. It is a group coaching program, because I was having a lot of people come to me and say, hey, man, how do I hear you talk, or how do I get coaching? And the average person couldn't afford just where I've gotten in my speaking level. So I said, you know what? Man, why don't I create a group coaching program where people can just pay a monthly fee, they have a class once a week, and it's on motivation and structure and goal setting and all the things that I'm teaching. So I just launched that. It's called the Overcome Army, and they can find that on my website also under the consulting page.
Very cool. Very cool. Thanks for coming on, Jason, and really appreciate it, man.
Jason, thank you, man. Thanks you for having me on.